This is Ridgely speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with a noted Indiana economist, speaker, and writer, Morton Marcus. He, of course, puts out the Eye on the Pie columns on a regular basis. We'll check in with him on some of his topics that he's covered here in Hoosier Economics. We also have another conversation for you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University today. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's time now to turn to noted Indiana economist, speaker, and writer Morton Marcus. Morton puts out an Eye on the Pie column that's oftentimes shown in area media as well across the state of Indiana, where he takes up some interesting topics involving economics in the Hoosier State. And certainly this time around, we have not only economic news, but they probably get related mixed in with a little politics, too. And Morton is with us from his office in Indianapolis. Hi, Morton. Thanks for being with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Let's start out first with one of the most recent columns you had out here talking about the Indiana census, or I should say the U.S. census, rather, for Indiana, and I guess how they were finding that how Indiana's changing its population size.
Yes, it's rather interesting. One of the things that we have going on in Indiana is generally out-migration of people from Indiana to other states. That is, more people moving out than moving in, and yet our population is growing. Our population is growing in part because we have more births than deaths, which is quite a natural situation, but it's also growing because of a rather strong international migration, which means people coming from other countries who end up living in the state of Indiana, and that accounts for about 40% of the growth of the population of Indiana.
Wow.
Now, none of this is necessarily good or bad. This is a lot of people making individual decisions about what they want to do with their lives, and I would hate to see the legislature sort of get itself up in a roar, arguing that we should do much more to keep people in Indiana who are here. This whole idea of free movement of population is extremely important to America and has been part of an American tradition for a long time. But we have this crazy notion that somehow Indiana ought to put state money to stop what they call a brain drain, and that we ought to go out and we ought to try to be attracting people from other places to come and move here. We're interfering with basic decisions that people are making for what's best for their own lives. And I'd hate to see people, parents telling their children, oh, no, you've got to come back and live here in Merrillville. No, you've got to come back home to Valparaiso, and you've got to live here. That's not necessarily healthy for the state.
I know. It seems like too that the only time this really comes up is whenever the moving van people happen to put out their survey, taking a look at the migration of population from one state to another, and it talks about, at least for here in Indiana's concern, how many people are coming in or moving out of the particular state.
Right. Well, those data are tricky because the people who move with a moving van are a specific segment of the population. They're generally families that are rather well established. When young people leave from college and move someplace else, they're not going in a moving van. And I think that we tend to look only at a very small segment of our population when we talk about the moving van situation. Lots of people move just by packing up a car or two cars and maybe a neighbor's car and a pickup truck, and that's how they move, and it isn't the moving van business. So I don't think that those studies are anything more than an advertisement for the specific moving van company that puts it out.
Yeah, I see. One of the recent columns also that you put out, Morton, focused in here about some of the latest data about Indiana's earnings deficit here, and started out here the first of the year looking at some data from 2017.
Yeah, we have some information. Indiana just doesn't pay very good wages. And what we want to do is we want to somehow blame workers for that and say our workers are inadequate. I like to say, and this is not very popular, I like to say that many of our companies are inadequate. Why is it that we feel, and the governor's going to talk about this tonight, mm-hmm. You know, Indiana's got to do something to improve its workforce. I think we've got to start with Indiana doing something to improve its management. And its management in the private sector, particularly, that is the problem. Why is it that companies are not training the workers that they need to train? And why is it that companies in Indiana don't want to support our public schools so that we can have a workforce that can read and write and show up on time? These are sort of basic activities that the schools need to engage in to get people workforce ready, and then it's the responsibility, as I see it, of the employers to train the workers that they want, instead of saying, well, it's, you know, we should have free tuition at Ivy Tech. Well, I'd rather see a situation where employers train the workers that they need.
Well, it's interesting to see if that'll come about, to be sure. See what local businesses as well as regional businesses have to say about that. One of the other columns, too, Morton, I know that you talked about here, was taking a look here about not only about high tech and what we should be doing as far as the workplace is concerned, but high tech personally. And I guess you brought it home in a column that you wrote here talking about a recent purchase of a new watch.
Yeah, I went out and I bought a nice watch for $20, which does everything that I need, which is it tells me what time it is.
Yes.
I don't really need much more. We have an awful lot of technology that does wonderful things for us, but so much of it is trivial, and I hate to think of how much money companies spend to do this. My wife showed me a trick that she does on her cell phone where she can send balloons and I don't know, flowers and hearts and such with a text message. Who cares? I see no reason for that to be there. But it costs something for a company to program that and put that into our watches or our cell phones. And I just don't see why they're spending money on that. They say, well, this is what the consumer wants. I don't think the consumers really care whether or not they have balloons and flowers and hearts for their text messages. And if it is, that's what consumers want, then I think these companies shouldn't be listening to 12-year-olds.
One of the other columns that you had recently put out called Eye on the Pie, earlier in December, Morton talked about the idea of being able to turn poverty into affluence. Maybe we need some definition of the two terms to begin with first, don't we?
Well, yes. We have a lot of trouble with that and always have because poverty is truly a relative term as is affluence. And what I think is more important is that we try to recognize through the way in which we pay people the value of what they do. There's a column I wrote recently as well about increasing the pay of janitors,
mm-hmm.
The people who keep our restrooms clean. I know a lot of businesses that are very well aware that customers will decide not to come back if they find that the restroom in a restaurant or any place of business is filthy. And I don't think there are enough owners of these businesses who pay attention to the condition of their restrooms. And I'm sure that when you and your family go out on a drive and you say, oh, so-and-so needs a restroom,
mm-hmm.
You have particular firms that you don't go to,
yeah.
Particular chains that you don't show up at. Anything that will turn away customers is a filthy restroom. But our janitors, even when they do a great job, just don't get paid very much.
Yeah.
And I think that it's time to say that the people who are concerned about public health ought to be paid appropriate money. And it's the same way that we have this whole situation of people who are caregivers in nursing homes and in all sorts of settings, particularly we're now moving into the pre-K education. The teachers in those pre-K schools should be given a great deal of respect and pay, because they're doing something extremely valuable for our society. And it's time to sort of turn those things around. It's wonderful to pay a football coach. What is it that John Gruden's going to get out there in Las Vegas with the Oakland team? $20 million for 20 years.
I think something like that. Yeah.
That's wonderful to be in the position to do that. But how much are we paying the people who are doing the essential jobs for our society?
Well, Morton, we have time to look at one more column in particular. This goes back into November of last year, and it starts out with the interesting, the headline is an interesting question. Who benefits from Hoosier labor? And you've kind of talked about this in the past on some of our other conversations, but you kind of bring this home here when you take a look at how the breakdown of Indiana's labor market seems to be these days.
Well, yeah, there's an interesting story we have is that productivity is increasing. Well, if productivity is increasing, then wages should be increasing. But the benefits, the way in which we get productivity increased very often is by giving the worker better tools. And yet it's the ownership of those tools that gets the rewards. That is, it's the people who make the automated equipment who are the ones who are getting the rewards rather than the people who are using them. What we're doing is we're taking the position that our workers really aren't contributing more. Even though we talk about labor productivity rising, our pay situation doesn't recognize that. And either we have to stop claiming that labor productivity is so wonderful and recognize it through the market forces. Otherwise, what we're doing is talking out of both sides of our mouths.
Morton Marcus is a noted Indiana economist as well as a speaker and a writer. He puts columns out. It's under Eye on the Pie. You can take a look at it on websites like Howie Politics Indiana and other places too. And we have him on occasionally to talk about some of the topics he brings up in the columns. And as always, Morton, thank you for being with us today and have him back on again real soon.
Okay. Have a good year.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
You're listening.
Bye
now. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener supported Lakeshore Public Radio. If you receive some expensive wine as a holiday gift, Ryan Fredrickson has an invention that can save some of that wine and money by keeping it from evaporating away. He's created a spray preservative, and he talked about it with us here on Regionally Speaking not long ago.
Like you said, I was an engineer in the argon industry, was traveling around quite a bit, almost like a corporate contractor for a company that was one of the largest inert gas companies in the world, and really got a chance and a taste for wine, but I was, you know, traveling, living alone, and noticed that it, as much as wine is great, you know, the taste, the aromas, and if you go out to the West Coast like I did, you get to see kind of the beauty of the vineyards and all the hard work that goes into every drop of wine. But at the end of the day, you're staring at five glasses in a single bottle of wine. You kind of have to commit to the whole bottle if you don't want any of it to go to waste. So I kind of thought about that. You know, we were designing oxidation prevention systems for the food and wine industry and kind of got to thinking, you know, maybe I could use my skills to actually, you know, decrease the waste. There was we did some research, and it was about $1.5 to $2 billion of wine was going down the drain every year, which is, you know, besides being good wine, which is unfortunate, it's something that I wanted to prevent. You know, it's something that I thought I could prevent.
What a fantastic waste of wine, to be sure. Well, let me ask, what do you think about the, obviously there have been inventions in the past coming up with ways to cork up a bottle of wine to keep the freshness in there. What do you think about all these other gadgets and devices that have been put out there already to try to preserve the freshness of wine? And what was it that made you feel that you could do one better with your invention?
A lot of need, so there's always going to be lots of people trying to solve the problem. We did look at some of the things out there. You know, there's systems up to a couple thousand dollars that will preserve wine, and there have been some attempts using nitrogen gas, actually, that were similar to ours, and based on my background, I said, you know, nitrogen's just not the right gas to use. For an application like this, we should definitely use argon. It's going to work better for our customers, and we're going to actually be able to preserve wine a lot better, so... It kind of, it was a hard question to answer for myself is what makes me think, eventually you got to say what makes me better. And I think it was just a true desire to reduce waste, starting with wine and my background designing systems that prevent oxidation that kind of hit the points on the head, I suppose.
Now, if somebody's interested in getting in ART Wine Preservers, first off, what does ART stand for?
Don't make fun of me. I'm an engineer first, right? ART stands for argon technology.
Well, I mean, you had to ask the question because, you know, it just makes sense that an engineer is going to come up with an idea first and they're going to find some way to, if you can, put that into the name of your product, because then you always have to market the product, and that's the important thing now. If somebody wants to get this ART wine preserver, what are they going to have in their hand once the package arrives from wherever it comes from, and what can they do to help preserve the wine once they have that in hand?
To answer the first question, where, you know, it comes from Chicago suburbs, we manufacture every single piece here in the USA, and most of it actually locally. The Chicago suburbs, there's a great manufacturing group out there that does a good job. In terms of what it is, to visualize it for our customers, basically it's a small canister, very similar to like a miniature version of what we were using in the food industry for our, your Kraft, your Purdue chicken, that sort of thing. Very, very similar to that. It's basically an aerosol can that is pure argon gas. Spray 2 seconds of this gas into your open bottle of wine. That's the dose we figured out that will create a protective layer over the wine within the open bottle. Then you stick a cork in it, and you're good for a couple of weeks.
That's great. That's great. Now, how has your marketing plan been going so far now to get this out so that more people have a chance to examine it and find out more and see if it really does make them feel happy about opening a bottle of wine?
The first place we've been going is wine professionals. So your sales teams, for distributors, your vineyards, that they're really concerned about their brand, and that every single drop of the wine that they're serving is at its peak. So we have we've talked with salespeople that have they're sampling bottles to their customers and trying to get them to buy a pallet of this stuff. So they really want it to be perfect, and they're some of the they're some of the quickest to dump a bottle of wine. So our marketing plan actually is to target these wine professionals, get them to really test it out in the field a lot every single day. And that's been pretty successful so far, actually. And if you can get the wine professionals to use it and to say, hey, this is really working, that's something that we hope they'll show their restaurant customers. And then once they start using it at the restaurant, the consumers will start to see it being used there.
You have this ART wine preserver. Any other products that you're thinking of?
My personal mission, the company mission, is to reduce waste, and we're starting with wine. So there are some other ideas, but we're very much focused on preserving wine right now. And hopefully, if we're able to successfully do that and grow as a company, we'll bring other waste reduction techniques to the food and other industries.
That's Purdue University engineering graduate and inventor Ryan Fredrickson, the creator of a wine-preserving spray. We're off into 2018, taking a look at resolutions, of course, of all sorts. Let's talk about financial resolutions here now. And, of course, we're turning out to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer for that. Greg, as we start the new year, we're making all kinds of resolutions on fitness and the diet. And it's not a bad idea to follow through what we could have done back in 2017 with what we should be doing in 2018.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people will just, go through their New Year's resolutions and not really think about financial being as significant as anything that you can do in creating a better future for yourself. And And a lot of times it's just simply starting with the basics.
Yeah.
You know, beginning with the budget is always one of the things that a lot of people never really do, and it's just something that gives you a strong foundation in terms of where your money's going.
It's very important because there's so many basic things that we should be probably doing, and maybe we are doing, we don't even think about that we're doing here, and such things about making sure that if we have a new child in the family, that we make sure that all the expenses are covered so that we know that we might be able to deduct whatever we can deduct and the like, too. And then talking about a new child in the family, maybe it's time to set up that that retirement account. Not too soon, I suppose.
No, it's never too soon. One of the things I always advocate for people is your best friend when it comes to investing is time. The longer the time horizon, the more consistent the performance if you make it a priority. And if you have time on your side, you pay yourself first, it's less money to accomplish those goals.
Yeah. And speaking of retirement accounts, we know that one of the important things to do, too, if you haven't done so already, is to make a promise to yourself and your New Year's resolutions to be sure that you contribute enough to your retirement account.
Yep, absolutely, especially folks that have a company program. It's structured. It's easy to follow. A lot of times there's matching dollars. I mean, if there's matching dollars, absolutely you want to take advantage of that. Most of your 401ks are going to have very good strategic positions. You can continue to contribute, and that dollars will accumulate, and things will continue to progress the way you want them to, and you don't even really notice it because it's not something you have to budget. It's coming right out of your paycheck.
One of the other things I know, too, that we always think about and talk about is insurance, especially when it comes to making sure that you have the right insurance. It's very important for your overall financial health, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think a lot of times people evaluate insurance after the fact. It's kind of one of those necessary evils. I'll be the first one to tell you, Chris, you know, I'm not a big fan of paying for insurance. But, you know, it's all about, mitigating that risk, that exposure, especially a lot of people, you know, don't even have anything in terms of a disability to cover those expenses. And that's where people end up getting into a lot of trouble because you don't have that coverage that it could help, keep you through the hard times when you don't have the income coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, like I said, I've never had anyone in a situation where they said, oh, there was too much life insurance. And it's about understanding what the value of that life insurance. So many people look at life insurance and say, oh, I have, you know, X amount, and don't realize what that relates to replacing the income. So having somebody educate you around and understand what insurance it takes to actually replace income is invaluable.
Yep. Are there some basic questions that you probably should be asking yourself on the type of insurance that you need to get?
Yeah, there's all different shapes and sizes of insurance, especially when it comes to life insurance. You'll hear so many people advocate different things. It's just a matter of what your objective is. You know, especially when it comes to, you know, what we call term insurance, it's a great way to get that higher amount of insurance when your needs are more. I have young kids. You know, I carry a lot of term because I want to make sure while they're young that, you know, there's that value there for that additional coverage. But then I also have permanent, you know, because there's things that I always want to have and there's values of that permanent coverage. And then you get into the disability and the long-term care. I think just having somebody explain to you the pros and cons so you can make your educated decision, which is part of the whole process of understanding your objectives and making a decision based on what mm-hmm. makes the most sense for you.
I always get a kick, and you're talking here for a moment ago here about disability insurance. I get a kick of the radio commercials that I hear talking about Big Lou, who they say Big Lou can help you out in getting you into the right kind of coverage because he's on meds too. That's very important. I mean, it's a joke, and they're just trying to be sure to sell this type of insurance, but that is important that the more type of insurance that you have that will cover any possibilities that you may face in life, whether it's current or future, I guess is a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things, you know, it's one of those things I always tell people, it's something you never want until you can't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you got to be proactive in those areas, and it's one of those things that it's, the way to obtain it is when the value isn't realized, and it's those things that you evaluate in that process just to make sure. I mean, listen, insurance is one of the most selfish acts you're ever going to, you know, do in your life because it's never about you. It's about the people you care about. I always tell people you buy it for two reasons. One, to take care of debt, or two, to take care of the people you love. And you just got to have that perspective when you go into those types of programs.
We're talking about New Year's financial resolutions with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. And one of the other points we want to make, too, I guess, and we've talked about this before, mainly lately here about the end of the year for taking advantage of charitable deductions, but it's just important to pay attention to your taxes year-round, isn't it?
And I think even more so this year, Chris, with the new tax laws, we've... You know, we do a significant number of returns, as you know, but at the end of the day, these tax laws, you know, they're telling them how much it's going to save people, but it's not going to necessarily provide savings for everybody. But there's two sides of it. If it's going to provide savings, is that an opportunity then to take that money and use it more constructively, you know, throughout the year? And these new laws need to be evaluated specifically for everybody's return. But for some, the people that itemize, they're going to lose those exemptions. The uptick in standard deduction may not benefit it, and they need to understand what their liability is going to be when they come in for the following tax year. Mm-hmm. So all those taxes, you know, taxes are always going to be a driving force. I use this example many times. My wife, it's not about what I make. It's about what gets deposited in the account. You know, those are the dollars we live on. Those are the dollars we use. And if there's a way to mitigate that exposure or take advantage of the new tax laws, you need to investigate that.
Now, from your own standpoint there with your business as a financial advisor, are you finding have you spent more time these days in particular with your clients talking about the changes in the new tax law?
Well, that's one of the biggest things. We actually addressed it yesterday as an organization, that we're going to try to find ways to implement that in through the first quarter, because it's going to be a lot of heavy lifting. You know, you got a lot of different changes, and it's not a standardized answer. Everybody individually, it's going to have a different impact for everybody's return based on what their specific situation is. And a lot of it's going to fall down to, are they itemizing? Because the itemized deductions are going to change. And if they're itemizing already, has the standard deduction increase really going to have an impact? And then you're going to lose those exemptions. And there's just all those little quirks that we're still evaluating that we basically determined there's no way to really understand the impact of each individual client without actually going through each individual tax return.
Are you finding that you're just now getting the information in from the Internal Revenue Service, the updates on the changes now, or are you still expecting a lot more to come here?
No, we're pretty confident that what they have is going to be, you know, what it is moving forward to 2018, and nobody has to worry about 2017. They purposely pushed it into 2018, so everything that was done last year is still the same guidelines, the same, you know, tax brackets, the same everything. But moving into next year, everybody just needs to be aware and cognitive of the fact that, you know, you need to evaluate and see how much the year-end result's going to be. You don't want to walk in, March of 2019 and find out, wow, I didn't expect this. You want to find out those surprises.
And finally here, Greg, let's talk about how important it is to educate yourself for making some very informed decisions.
Well, and I think that's the biggest key. You know, a lot of people you need to absorb that information and understand, you know, how things would benefit you from your situation. But a lot of people will get news and they'll get highlights of things that are out there in the media, in the papers, and it doesn't necessarily pertain to their specific situation. So the more education you get and the more you understand about these concepts, these programs, these different types of products, the easier it's going to be for you to evaluate whether or not it's going to bring value to your personal situation.
Well, Greg, thanks for spending time with us to talk about these New Year's financial resolutions as we go into 2018, and I'm sure we'll talk again about some of these in more detail a little bit later.
Thanks, Chris. Enjoyed it.
Thank you. Greg Hampers, our Northwest Indiana financial advisor, we come to talk about these topics and get some advice from him. Design technology students at the Ivy Tech Community College over in Valparaiso have helped come up with a 3D model of a car part for none other than famous TV celebrity Jay Leno. And for that, we find out more from Jason Gordon, head of the department of the design technology program there at Ivy Tech in Valparaiso. And Jason, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Chris.
And we're being joined as well, too, by Susan Perry, who is the Dean of Technology for Ivy Tech in Valparaiso, Valentina Petruski, who is a member of the program and a member of the team that helped work on this part. Thank you both to you, Susan, and to Valentina for being with us as well.
Design technology is it's a wonderful growing field right now. It's really the language of technology. We teach all kinds of software programs here, AutoCAD and SolidWorks and Revit, BIM, all kinds of stuff like that, and we're actually venturing into Fusion starting next year. So we're really excited. We have a lot of employers calling us at this time, and we're doing all kinds of interesting things with architecture and graphic design, and in our case here with the Jay Leno part, mechanical design, mm-hmm. using our new 3D printer, a Strata system printer that's state-of-the-art.
Tell us, if you will, a little bit about this part. It's a 1929 Duesenberg that Jay Leno owns. How did he end up having to have this part in the first place?
Well, I read that he's actually got a few 3D printers himself, but they're not the top-of-the-line printers. And I thought, you know, this would be a wonderful project for our students to get involved in. A lot of them are, of course, fans of his show. And he was looking. I contacted his agent. He actually gave me a call back, which really surprised me. And he had mentioned that he really likes to help schools and education, and that's a passion of his. So he wanted to help us, and I got a call from his mechanic the next day, and they sent a STL file to us, and we were able to print it later that week.
That's great. That's great. What is the difference that you've noted in being able to create a car part by the 3D printer as compared to, say, you know, taking that part, putting it in a sand mold, and casting something out of metal from it?
Well, often what will happen is that you print the 3D part first, and then you may do a casting after that. There's times where the parts don't exist anymore, or you may have a part that has been scanned that's damaged, and we can digitally reproduce that and correct the problem. Say there's a dent in the part or part of it is missing, we can correct that, 3D print it, and then it can be cast.
Richard Morose is a member of the staff there at Ivy Tech Valparaiso, and he's an instructor in the class involving robotics. Rich, if you will, tell us a little bit about the 3D printer that was used to make this part for Jay Leno for his Duesenberg.
Well, this 3D printer works similar to a inkjet printer. It has several nozzles. It uses a liquid resin that's ejected from these nozzles, and it does several passes. And then it's cured by a UV light. Each layer is cured by a UV light, and as the part is built from the bottom up. And then it's basically that's it. I mean, it works different than other 3D printers. It's more precise, and it's more detailed.
Mm-hmm. 5 thou, it'll be as precise as 5 thou of an inch, which is basically the spec for machining with a CNC machine.
Uh-huh. Now, is this part now stronger than something either the original part that might have been made for the original Duesenberg, or even for that matter a remanufactured part? That, you know, like I said, if you try to cast something or with some other material, is this new part made by the 3D printer stronger than the original?
Well, we have several materials we can make this part out of.
Mm-hmm.
There's 12 different materials that this printer can print. Basically, this part could be used. It's strong enough to use on a car, but it's strictly, he was going to use it to cast a one out of brass, I believe it was,
right,
and then have it chromed or whatever he was going to do.
Right. I see.
But what you might find interesting is that this 3D printer doesn't just do a poly, it'll also do a rubberized material, and will do clear material. A matter of fact, the part we printed was a clear material, and which can have all kinds of great applications. We also did a Harley-Davidson engine, didn't we, Richard?
It was a lawnmower engine.
Oh, it was a lawnmower engine?
Where
you can see the parts moving on the inside, yeah, because it's a clear material.
Well, it sounds like it would be great for instructional purposes that you can, you know, as far as trying to teach somebody how an internal combustion engine works, you know, something like the old days when toys were made out of plastic to see the working parts of a machine.
That's exactly right. As a matter of fact, today we're printing for our medical area here at Ivy Tech. We're printing an MRI version of a human brain. So that's made of a rubberized material, and so that our students over in nursing can look at it and study it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you should note that. Let's bring Susan Perry, the Dean of Technology there at Ivy Tech in Valparaiso, in on the conversation. Now, Susan, when you hear and learn about these things that the Design Technology Program has been doing, how does this fit into the overall mission of the department?
Oh, it just fits in perfectly, Chris. We're so happy to have this opportunity. And when Jason told me that he received a message from Jay Leno, it's like, wow, that's really quite awesome. the things we emphasize in all of our classes is that hands-on experience, Chris. And we have the theory, of course, but every class in design, as well as our technology programs, are very, very hands-on. And we look for those real-life opportunities wherever we can. So this was a perfect fit with what kind of experience we like our students to have when they leave here.
Well, now, Jason, now that this part's been taken care of, it's been created by the 3D printer and sent off to Jay Leno's Big Dog Garage out there in Burbank, California. Any response back from the folks out at California about how the part seems to fit in into what Jay Leno had hoped to have done on the vehicle?
Actually, they called me back the next day after they received it, and they were ecstatic. And it looks like they may give us some more parts. So we're pretty excited about that. And we're grateful that they did that. We think that we're trying to open up this printer to industry, especially here in Indiana. So if there's any companies out there that would like to work with us, we'd really be happy to do that. And, of course, any students that are interested, please give us a call. Classes start up in the spring, so we'd love to have you. And it's an exciting field. Think about it. You can almost replicate anything. As long as we have a scanner, we can almost replicate anything. So it's an exciting field right now. And I hope we can work with Jay again. Richard and I were tossing up who was going to drive this part down to California, but unfortunately, we had classes and we had to mail it.
Oh, too bad. Well, maybe if you get more business from the Big Dog Garage for other vehicles that Jay Leno or some other people that have vehicles in the garage that will have to be worked on and need to be replaced, maybe you'll get some other business and they'll give you that opportunity to be able to drive out to Burbank, California and deliver it in person.
Yeah, that would be great. I'd like to drive one of his Stanley Steamers, actually.
That's true. You get a chance if you go out to the garage, you get to see his fleet that's out there parked in the area out there too. It'll be great to see that as well too. Valentina, as far as working with the students are concerned on this project, what kind of reaction did the students have about having an opportunity to do a little robotics work as well as actually see something made and actually turn into something that somebody will use?
Actually, they are so excited. Students are always excited about projects when they can use some critical thinking skills and do the hands-on, you know, project-based learning, and they just getting so engaged. You know, they form in teams, and it just works so well for them, and it's a great thing they can put in their resume and get a better internship or a job opportunity. Just so, so exciting for them. I think students are more excited than the instructors.
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah, it might be a toss-up on that, too. But it's also good to know, too, that you know the word will get around among the students that if they're interested in taking this class here for this next year coming up, that they'll get involved in making more projects as well, too. It'd be interesting to see what does come about it here. We've been talking with Valentina Petrushki, as well as with instructor Richard Maroche, and with the Dean of Technology at Ivy Tech Community College, Valparaiso Campus, Susan Perry, and Jason Gordon, who is the chairman of the Design Technology Program. It's been the program that's been very involved in creating a 3D model of a car part for Jay Leno to be able to use in one of his fleet of the beautiful antique vehicles that he has at the Big Dog Garage out in Burbank, California. And thank you all for being with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about this and hope to get more word of more great parts, not only for Jay Leno, but for other people as well, too, that are made there at the Ivy Tech Community College campus in Valparaiso.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Chris.
Annie Clark, better known as St. Vincent, spoke with Kyle Meredith recently about the writing of a record for the activities that she's done for her in between the LPs that she's put out, as well as being the subject of some interesting tabloid culture.
The Speed Up Sound with Kyle Meredith.
If St. Vincent's last five albums hadn't convinced you that she was one of the most important artists of our day, Mass Seduction should seal the deal. Balancing huge hooks with unannounced detours, both musically and lyrically, it's at once one of the catchiest and craziest records of the year. Annie Clark gave us a call to talk about writing the record, her activities between LPs, and being the subject of tabloid culture. I'm Kyle Meredith at The Speed of Sound.
I finished touring in the St. Vincent record in the fall of 2015, and I started writing kind of immediately, which is my way, because I realized I actually don't know what I think or feel until I write it in some way, be it like, you know, an essay or a song. That is really my way to understanding myself. So that was something I kind of needed to do right after I stopped touring, because I wasn't sure how I felt about any of it. And I made a short horror film, which I think really it was just so nice to do something else, frankly. And I don't know, I guess I'm a person who's always enjoyed work more than fun.
You're not getting up from this table until you eat that pizza. Do you understand me? Just eat!
If you don't eat, eventually you'll die.
So?
That horror film, I've only seen the trailer, but when I listened to the record, I thought there are moments in this album when the music sounds like it could have been a horror soundtrack.
Well, I mean, I was making a lot of different kinds of music. I mean, this album is what it is because these are the strongest songs. And this is what was supposed to happen and come together eventually working with Jack Antonoff. But I have music for days. I mean, just what people, it's like an iceberg, you know. As a writer, it's like an iceberg, you know. People only see the top, but there's an entire world of unheard music underneath it, you know. I can't turn off what turns me on. I can't turn off what turns me
on. You know, here's a point in your career where you've created this amazing guitar, and then there's a line on the record where you say, I hold you like a weapon, which I don't know if is a guitar, but I thought about that, and I said, and it's a synth-heavy record.
There is a lot of guitar. It just doesn't, it might not sound exactly like guitar. I mean, I've always done that, where guitar has been a little, you know, gone through the looking glass. I mean, the live show I'm playing constantly. People just might not recognize it as guitar.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, that doesn't bother me. Guitar will always be a strong presence.
And like, there's these moments all throughout the record that's, you know, the lyrics are like what you did with the cities and how you tied it into relationship. I mean, it's, you've always had a great knack of these lyrics and to marry this really interesting music.
Thank you very much. I spent so long making sure that every word was right. When asked about the creative process, which I am, you know, I guess almost daily, it's mysterious to me. These things emerge and you slowly but surely have this cohesive work that all interlinks with each other. I mean, the song Mass Seduction more or less lays out all the characters that you meet in the record. And the, you know, I Can't Turn Off What Turns Me On might as well be the thesis, you know, of the record.
Another line in there, and I feel like this is one of those lines that any artist would really want to avoid explaining, or and maybe you feel like about all your lyrics, but what a bore to be so adored.
I mean, I was thinking about actually a Brian Eno line from Here Come the Warm Jets, where he sings, oh, what a burden to be so relied on.
Yeah.
I was thinking of it in that kind of tone, you know. Oh, what a burden to be so
relied on. I'll say that you grew from this really, you know, you grew from a cult rock icon to being part of celebrity tabloid gossip rags. And I sort of took it a little bit from like, that's got to be weird. That's just got to be a weird point in anybody's life.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. What's strangest to me about it, and just the one thing that I'll say about it, is that a part of the whole celebrity culture thing is this aspect of wealth aspiration and fame aspiration that bums me out only because what it says to me is that we as a culture and we as government have not taken care of our people. Because I think if people were happier or more contented and it wasn't just the corrosive side of capitalism all the time, then there wouldn't be these false idols. So that's my assessment of it. They can see, oh, here I am, your pain
machine. I am like you. You're to that point. I mean, you're to the point where your lyrics are being seriously analyzed with a fine-tooth comb, and you know, the people are dissecting every part of this because you have this life in the public eye. And you know, it's got to be a big transition for everybody. I know it spells success in the end. I hope it does. But just to kind of grasp onto all of that and then work that into the art, it goes back to, you know, your relationship with your audience. And you and I had talked about before as a performer and a manipulator. It's a really interesting way that you've pulled all of this off.
Thank you. Well, I think one aspect of it is that I've gotten more successful in a sort of slow and steady manner, like the tortoise and the hare. So when I was confronted with that, like super mainstream, like tabloid, whatever, celebrity gossip rag stuff, I knew who I was and I knew who my friends were. And so it wasn't like a tectonic shift in my life. It was just something that I had to kind of figure out where to put it, how to deal with it.
It's Annie Clark of St. Vincent and the music of the Mass Seduction LP. For more of my interviews, you can head over to Facebook or Twitter at Kyle Meredith. And thanks to Brad Yost for co-producing this episode. And from the studios of WFPK in Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Kyle Meredith at The Speed of Sound.
Speed of Sound with Kyle Meredith can be heard Tuesdays and Fridays here on Lakeshore Public Radio, and you can catch the podcast of the program on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.